Chapter 5 Coruscant, the Jedi Temple, Quarters of Luke and Mara Skywalker. Luke and Mara kept an apartment away from the Jedi Temple, but also quarters in the temple itself, austere chambers for those times when late-night council meetings or other duties made it more practical to walk a few dozen meters and fall over, rather than board a speeder and fly kilometers to do the same. Sometimes those temple quarters served an additional purpose, such as when the Skywalkers found themselves in command of a surly, defiant Jedi son who was certain that unfairness was a force power and his parents were its masters. The silence and chill radiating from the boy's room, one door down a common hallway, were formidable. Luke, pacing, was certain he could feel them like air blowing through a wampa's meat locker. He turned in mid-pace to look at his wife. "How is it that I feel guilty?" Sitting on the bed, Mara looked up from her datapad.
"You're feeling guilty. We are, because he's unhappy. And he's going to continue being unhappy until we stop slandering and persecuting Jason, the perfect Jedi, hero of the people and male model for black uniforms, or until he grows up enough to revise his thinking about his cousin." She sighed.
"Do you think we can brick him into his room until he does grow up?"
"Tempting."
Luke resumed his pacing.
"How long did it take you to stop being a headstrong kid who made as many bad decisions as good ones?"
Luke shrugged in mid-stride. "I don't know. From the time Uncle Owen and Aunt Beru were murdered to the time I started calling myself Master. About 4 years."
"I'll set the timer, then. It should go off when he's just about to turn 18. We can check then and see if he followed your example."
That elicited a dry chuckle. "All right. We need to figure out what to do with him now. We've got him in the temple, where dozens of Jedi eyes can keep an eye on him when we're not around, which is bound to make him more paranoid and angry. What do we do to make him learn?"
"Give him a project, something relevant, such as write a history and analysis of his grandfather's fall to the dark side."
Luke stopped again to stare at his wife. "That's complex psychology to assign to a 13-year-old.
"Almost 14. I'm thinking that if he does his homework, he'll recognize a similarity in the decisions made by Anakin Skywalker and Jason Solo."
Luke moved over to sit beside her. "That could be helpful. But how do we make sure he does his homework? What do we use to motivate him?"
Mara took a deep breath.
"We tell him that if we like his work enough to submit it to the Jedi Library, we'll let him resume his duties as Jason's apprentice."
Luke whistled. "Very chancy."
"Yes, but several things might happen by the time Ben has finished his project to our satisfaction. We might become convinced that Ben can see Jason's flaws, his problems. Jason might recognize his mistakes and become a fit teacher again. Jason might die."
"I could feel Jason in the Force a few minutes ago. That's a rare thing these days. He hides from it whenever he wants. And just now he was channeling it, very strongly. I wonder what he's up to." Before Mara could reply, Luke's comlink beeped. He pulled it out and thumbed its switch. "Yes?"
"Grandmaster Skywalker, this is Apprentice Siha in the reception hall."
The voice was female, young, breathlessly enthusiastic.
"There is a man here who wishes to see you. He won't see any other master."
"What's his name and his business with me?"
"He says his name is Twinsons Flea. He doesn't have any identification to corroborate that. He says his mission concerns a lightsaber with a silver blade."
Luke and Mara exchanged a look. Luke thumbed the comlink microphone off. Twinsons.
Twin sons three?
Mara nodded.
That's what it sounds like.
Twin Suns Squadron was an X-Wing unit formed by Luke during the Yuuzhan Vong War more than a dozen years before. He had led it for a while, then turned command over to Jaina. It had been decommissioned after the war had ended, but in the years since, Luke had occasionally given the designation temporarily to ad hoc squadrons he'd commanded.
Who was Twin Suns Three?
Mara continued.
At various times, several different people.
Luke thought back to a recorded hologram message he'd viewed only a few days before, a message sent by Han describing his and Leia's recent encounter on Telker Station.
Jag fell, he said. Han said he was back. As for a silver lightsaber,
silver blades were rare on lightsabers, and a woman who had once owned one of them had recently been of serious concern to Luke, though her new lightsaber had a different blade color.
Ali Marar,
Mara said.
Right.
Luke thumbed the comlink back on.
Tell our visitor we'll be right up.
Their visitor was only a little over average height, but stood so straight that he seemed much taller. Dressed in a black flight suit and engulfed by a dark gray traveler's cloak, his face shadowed, he looked more like a forbidding figure from a cautionary children's tale than a peaceable visitor. The darkness of the lofty temple reception hall, with most of its glow rods extinguished because of the late hour and shadows gathering in every corner, reinforced his somber manner. Siha, the receiving apprentice on duty, bowed to Luke and Mara as they entered. She twirled a lock of red hair around nervous fingers. At Luke's gesture, she moved out into the main corridor. Luke and Mara approached the visitor. Luke could read very little from him. No sense of menace, but also not one of friendliness. Perhaps a trace of anger deeply buried.
Colonel Fell, Luke said.
Jag bowed and offered a little heel click.
At your service, he said.
He reached up to throw back his cloak hood, revealing the features Luke remembered. His was a lean face with startlingly bright green eyes and a scar leading up from his brow to his hairline. His hair was still dark, a bit longer than the military haircut he had once typically worn, with a mop of it hanging almost into his right eye. Where his scar entered his hairline, one stripe of hair was white. The trim, rakish beard and mustache were new, and gave him an even greater resemblance to his father, the famous Soontir Fell. Luke stepped forward to stretch out a hand.
Why the secrecy? You could have visited us officially, with your credentials.
There are no credentials.
Jag shook Luke's hand, then Mara's, when she offered it.
I'm no longer a colonel. No longer an ambassador. No longer a citizen of the Chiss. No longer even a member of my father's house. Technically, that suggests I'm no longer even Jagged Fell. I'm as much Twin Sons Three as I am anything else.
Ah. Luke considered. Jag wasn't awash in self-pity, wasn't seeking sympathy with his words. He was just letting Luke in on things the Jedi Master needed to know. And if I understand correctly, your mission here has something to do with Ali Marar.
Everything to do with her.
Take a walk with us,
Mara said. They walked through the halls of the temple, which were mostly dim and little trafficked at this hour, and Jag told the Jedi Masters in unemotional tones of the events of his last few years, how during the Dark Nest missions he had guaranteed the parole of Lobaka, how Lobaka had violated that parole, how the damage done by Lobaka and his Jedi friends had become the responsibility of the Fell family, how Jag had been exiled from that family as a matter of consequence and honor, how Jag had been shot down on the world of Tanoop and had survived there,
a lean and dangerous existence for 2 years. How Alima Rar, mad as a half-crushed bug, and carrying within her mind the dual imperatives to recreate the Dark Nest and avenge herself on Luke and Leia, had also survived, also escaped. "In those 2 years," Jag concluded, "I gave a lot of thought to Alima Rar, to what she was, what she could do. Afterward, I continued researching her and investigating ways to counter her Killick abilities. She can scrub herself from the short-term memory of people, meaning that you can run into her and, if you survive, moments after the encounter, you have no memory of meeting her. It makes her terribly hard to track. Her Killick abilities and remaining Jedi powers make her an extreme danger to you and your sister, and to the galaxy."
"So you've come here to warn me," Luke said. "I appreciate that.
More than that, I come with gifts."
From a tunic inner pocket, Jag drew 2 items. One was the shape and size of a large cred coin, but silvery and featureless. No portrait of a long-dead hero or deserved-to-be-dead tyrant graced its faces, though a blob of some whitish substance adhered to one side. The other item was a common data card. He handed the card to Mara.
"This is a graphical interpreter and communications program," he said. "It operates in concert with most security holocam programs found in government installations, capital ships, any secure building. Basically, it evaluates every humanoid figure the cam sees, comparing them with a database of Alima Rar's unusual physical characteristics. And when it finds a match, it notifies the security department and sends a coded message to any data repository you specify. If you can get this installed on enough systems, we can perhaps plot her movements, find out her whereabouts before she does any more harm."
"That may not be as useful as you think," Luke said. "Alima probably knows the technique of the Force Flash, a method by which a Jedi can cause interference with holocams, even ones she's unaware of, in order to avoid being recorded." Jag frowned, but he did not seem daunted.
"This technique, does it make her invisible?"
Mara shook her head. "No. It creates a little static on the recording. Causes a sort of timing hiccup."
"That's not so bad," Jag said. "Part of the code involves analyzing incidence progression along a sequence of holocams, tracking an identified target. If we extend its analysis to these hiccups and assign a probability that they indicate a single force-using individual, the code could still plot her movements in observed areas."
"That might be useful in detecting Lumia, too." Mara pocketed the card. "Thank you."
"Also on that card are complete schematics for this, so you can reproduce it." Jag handed the coin-like object to Luke. "You use the sticky material to affix this to your neck, or to a shaved spot on your skull. You activate it by saying Alima. Deactivate it by tapping it twice with a fingernail."
He demonstrated, tapping it as it lay in Luke's open hand.
"From the time it's activated until it's deactivated, it sends electric shocks through your nervous system at 1 standard minute intervals."
Luke grinned. "That's helpful. Did you also bring me a brooch that will pinch my skin from time to time?"
"The shock," Jag continued humorlessly, "is very precisely attuned to human nervous systems. I haven't had the resources to determine the exact frequency needed by other species. The specific pain generated helps cause whatever is in your short-term memory to be transferred into long-term memory."
"Ah." Luke looked at the device more closely. "Meaning that Alima..." The disc began vibrating in his palm. Hastily, he tapped it twice, and it ceased vibrating. "Meaning that she can't slip back out of your memory again."
"That's right."
Mara frowned. "You know, we ought to be able to duplicate that effect with use of the Force." Luke nodded. "It's worth researching.
I'd prefer a force technique to going through something like Circus Bantha obedience training. I'll put Master Silgal on it. He tucked the disc into a belt pocket. Fel, thank you. I mean that. Is there anything we can do for you? At last, Jag sounded uncertain.
I hesitate to ask.
Don't, Mara said. I mean, don't hesitate.
I don't have anything to do,
Jag said, and his voice became curiously hollow. Empty. Except chase Alima Rar until I run her to ground and make sure she can't do any more harm. But I don't have much in the way of resources. No transportation. Little funding. He chuckled. So odd to be living in the private sector. In the military, they give you a mission and whatever resources they can offer. Sometimes too few, sometimes too many. Repeat until you retire or die. Outside the military, everything is so complicated.
Luke clapped him on the back. I'll get you resources.
Starting with some quarters.
No, I have a room. The address and my comm code and frequency are on the data card. I'd prefer not to stay here.
All right.
I'll go now. I can find my way out.
With a final bow to the Jedi Masters, Jag turned, correctly, Luke noted, despite the many twists and turns their walk had taken them through, toward the temple's main entrance, and strode away, pulling his hood up as he walked. Mara watched him go and shook her head.
That's a man with not enough to live for.
He'll bounce back, Luke said. He's young. He fingered the device Jag had given him. Come on. Let's see if Silgal is still up. Returning to the temple from a late errand, Jaina passed the lone Jedi performing guard duty at the building's wide-open main entrance and walked into the main corridor. Just leaving was a man wrapped up in a dark cloak. He kept to the left side of the corridor, away from her, not even appearing to notice her. She hesitated as they came abreast of each other, his upright posture, military bearing, and the unconscious arrogance of his stride causing bells to sound in her memory. When he was one step past her, she stopped and turned her head to look at him.
Jag?
He stopped too, but did not turn. His face remained completely hidden within the folds of his hood. But it was Jag Fell's voice that answered,
Yes?
Were you just going to walk past? Not even say hello?
Yes.
And then he was gone. Swallowed up by the Coruscant night beyond the doors. Gindyne System, Tendrondo Refueling and Repair Station. Hands on hips, Han stood in the lounge of the vehicle now parked alongside the Millennium Falcon.
You have got to be kidding.
If you'll forgive me, Captain Solo, C-3PO said, Master Calrissian's vocal mannerisms, though laced with humor, do not suggest that his basic thesis was in jest.
Han glared at the gold-toned protocol droid, then returned his attention to his surroundings. The lounge was, if not a thing of beauty, a testimonial to obsessive detail. The walls and ceiling were covered by thick, velvety material in a dark blue that matched the deep carpet on the floor. Silver glow-rod housings, polished to a dazzling level of reflectivity, protruded at tasteful intervals from the walls and ceilings. Furniture included four comfort couches, each with ceiling-mounted semi-transparent privacy curtains that would glide into position or retract at the touch of a button. Controls for the couch's temperature and vibration settings were mounted on silver panels inset in the velvet walls. Hanging chairs of woven plant stock, plated in a silvery surface, were suspended from the ceiling. Gleaming tables stood nearby to bear the weight of platters of food, and a water fountain reproducing in miniature form a famous waterfall from the world of Naboo
burbled in the center of the chamber. Leia, beside Han, nodded.
It's even more crass than the Lady Luck.
Lando, facing them from across the room to view their first reactions to the pleasure pit, smirked.
She's a bit like the lady. An older model. A Soro Sub 2400 yacht. Her owner, her former owner, fell on hard times, and they got harder when he decided to win back his fortunes in a sabacc match I was sitting in on.
He shrugged.
We had a lot in common, including taste in luxury yachts, but not including the fact that he drinks while gambling. I won his craft and a year's contract for his services as a salesman. He's marketing my droids in the Outer Rim now, and conveniently, the yacht is still officially registered in his name, since I somehow haven't found time to file the change of ownership documentation.
What's her name? Leia asked.
Lando modulated his voice to its richest, most seductive tones.
The Love Commander.
He stretched out the word love, an exercise in mockery. Leia looked at him as though he could not possibly be telling the truth. At his confirming nod, she put her hands over her mouth, the better to restrain any laughter that might emerge. Han shook his head.
I don't want to say what I think of her as a vehicle, but as a disguise, she's perfect.
He pulled his left arm from its sling and flexed his hand experimentally. Several weeks' worth of medical treatments since he sustained the injury and a good night's sleep had improved his condition somewhat, and his manner suggested he would soon be his old fighting self.
Let's move our gear from the Falcon to the master cabin, he told Leia.
Lando shook his head.
No, you're in the biggest of the guest cabins. I'm in the master cabin.
They both looked at him.
You're coming along? Leia asked.
After due consideration, it seems to me that you'll be a lot more anonymous as my pilot and navigator. Me being Beskat Ofterman, hollow entertainment mogul and pleasure seeker of the corporate sector, rather than the faces the authorities see whenever they establish communications with the Love Commander. Right?
Well, Leia considered, that's true. But I don't look forward to Tendra tracking us down and killing us if we get you hurt.
She'll be glad to get me out of the home for a while. She knows how twitchy I've been lately.
Lando picked up his cane and twirled it theatrically.
Come on, nameless crew. Let's get to it.
Han clapped C-3PO on his metal shoulder.
Goldenrod, you get the most important mission of all. You stay here and record every single thing they do to the Falcon during repairs. And try not to talk to them while you're doing it.
Oh, dear.
An hour later, personal possessions moved aboard and pre-flight checklists completed, Han, sitting at the navigator's console, was a bit more favorably disposed toward the Love Commander. Despite the yacht's name and pleasure-oriented mission, despite her swirly, mood-altering sky-blue and green exterior paint job, the vehicle wasn't a bad choice for their current needs. At 50 meters, she was nearly twice the length of the Falcon, but didn't mass much more, having a long, sleek design with two outrigger propulsion pods, one on either side, each carrying sublight ion drive and hyperdrive components. The hyperdrives were nothing special, but the ion drives had been rebuilt and overbuilt, giving the yacht considerable speed in sublight situations. Nor was she unarmed, though at first glance it had appeared she was. A pop-up turret, hidden beneath an artfully concealed access plate on the top hull, held a turbo laser. At the bow beneath the bridge,
was a concussion missile port hidden behind a false dish in a sensor array. And the yacht did have shields, though the shield generator, appearing to be an auxiliary hatch, lay folded down against the top hull when not in use and would take a few seconds to raise into position and become active. Now, with Leia in the pilot's seat, at Lando's insistence, since Han was not yet fully healed, and Lando in the oversized, preposterously comfortable captain's chair at the rear of the command cabin, the Love Commander lifted ponderously from her berth, backed on repulsor lifts away from the Falcon, and slid stern first into vacuum.
"Where to, Navigator?" Lando asked, activating his chair's massage vibration. "Someplace interesting, I hope."
"Should be interesting enough."
Han finished putting their course into the nav computer.
"Corellia. We're going to zip through the exclusion zone, laughing at the Alliance picket vehicles trying to blow us up. Then we're going to drop down to the planet's surface, determine whether Prime Minister Dirk Gedgen was acting alone when he ordered the hit on Tenel Ka, which probably means beating a confession out of him, and then deciding whether to forgive him or kidnap him and his co-conspirators and bring them to justice."
"Oh," Lando asked,
"what do we do on day two?"
Despite himself, Han snorted, amused.
"We'll figure something out."
"Well, wake me when we get there, whatever your name is."
Empty space. Engine compartment of the Duracrud. Captain Uren Levent lay on the grimy Durasteel deck, half propped up against an almost equally grimy wall, and waited to die. Her tools lay scattered on the deck, along with the deck plates she had pulled up, plates that gave her access to the various components of Duracrud's hyperdrive. The only sounds to be heard were her own breathing and the distant rhythmic noises made by the ship's life support system. There were no lights on in the ship except here, mechanics' glow rods magnetically clamped to offer light to the hyperdrive compartment, and on the bridge, where status lights should still be winking in their various colors. Levent knew it would take her a long time to die. The Duracrud would continue to provide breathable air for weeks. The stores of food and water would run out first, in a few days. She'd have plenty of time to record and transmit a few final messages. One would denounce Jason Solo for his treachery. One would confirm that her will, on file with an advocate's office on remote Tatooine, did accurately record her final wishes. She might even record a final speech, something to put her life into perspective. Then she'd die of thirst. Or, if she chose to end her suffering faster, she could shoot herself or step out an airlock. But one thing she could be sure of. Given the remote, untraveled nature of the spot she'd chosen for her first hyperspace jump, no cargo vessel or fast-moving courier would ever chance upon her. And her last transmissions, traveling at the speed of light, would take 8 years to reach the nearest star. She was as alone and doomed as anyone in the universe could be.
"Delicious, isn't it?"
The voice was female, and came from outside the meager light provided by Levent's glow rods. Levent jerked upright. She grabbed for her blaster, then remembered it was with her holster belt in her cabin. She'd left it there when collecting her tools.
"Who's there?"
"Your suffering, we mean," the voice continued. "You suffer like a child who cries herself to sleep each night, knowing that her parents will never, ever understand. How long has it been since you were that child?"
Levent rose on shaky legs and began to edge her way back to the door out of this compartment. At the door, she could turn on the overhead glow rods and see who was tormenting her. But she almost didn't want to turn on those lights. What if there was no one in the compartment with her? What if recognition of her fate had driven her crazy, and she was doomed to spend her last few days hearing voices? As if reading her mind, the voice in the darkness laughed. Levint reached the doorway, found the light control by touch, and activated it. The overheads came on, bright, blinding her. And then, as her eyes adjusted, she saw her visitor. And she knew she was not crazy, because her accumulated experiences and neuroses would never concoct a being like the one she saw. Her visitor was a blue Twi'lek woman of no unusual size. She was dressed in a dark traveler's robe and black clothes. Her features were pretty, but she had obviously been the victim of catastrophe at some point in her life. Her left shoulder was lower than her right, with her left arm hanging in such a way that Levint suspected it was non-functional, and her right head tail had been severed at about the halfway point. And now, as she stepped forward, she limped. This was no monster in the night or phantom of the imagination. Levint stared, incredulous.
"Who are you?"
"We are Alima."
"Alima? And what are you doing here?"
"We are a stowaway."
Levint stared at Alima for a few moments more, and then it happened. The laugh came bubbling up out of her like a high-pressure Santa spray stream. The laugh became a painful howl. It shook her, and it kept coming. Dizzied, Levint bent over to rest her hands on her knees and rested her backside against the bulkhead. Otherwise, she would have fallen. Finally, her laughter trailed away, leaving her throat hoarse, her body weary. Alima's expression did not change, except to become slightly curious.
"Why do you laugh?"
"Because you're the worst stowaway in the galaxy. In history."
Levint straightened.
"Because you picked the worst possible ship to stow away on. The hero of the Galactic Alliance sabotaged my hyperdrive."
"We know this. We watched his agents do it."
That snapped Levint out of her manic mood.
"You watched it?"
"Yes."
"And got on board anyway?"
"Yes."
Alima smiled.
"No, we do not wish to die. We stowed away after making sure of what the agents had done, and after acquiring the parts needed to repair the drive."
Levint took an involuntary step forward.
"You can fix it?"
"Yes, though we will only fix it if you are dead. But if you and we come to terms, you will live, and you will repair the drive."
Levint had to parse that statement. Alima's use of "we" to refer to herself caused her sentences to jump through flaming hoops like a carnival bantha.
"You mean, if we come to terms, I make the repairs, and we both get out of here. If we don't come to terms, you presumably kill me, and then you make the repairs, and you get out of here."
Alima's smile broadened.
"Good. Yes."
"What are your terms?"
"You help us find the parents of that hero of the Galactic Empire. You act as a public face for us in that search. You do not reveal our presence to the authorities. You do not attack or unnecessarily endanger us. You are one of the smugglers, yes? You use your knowledge of smuggling to help in this search."
She furrowed her brow for a moment, then relaxed.
"You treat us as an esteemed paying passenger."
"And once you've found the Solos?"
"You will have fulfilled your obligation."
Levint considered her options. She'd always admired Han Solo, and this woman's obvious need to stay out of public sight didn't argue well for what her intentions were when she found him. Levent could ask, but then she'd have to decide whether she was willing to object and ruin this deal, if Falima's intentions were hostile. Well, if they were, she could admire Han Solo as a unique piece of galactic history.
I agree.
Good. We will find the replacement components where we have hidden them. We will even hand them to you as you effect repairs.
Much obliged.